when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
In 2020, events have yet again shone a light on racial inequalities across the globe. Australia is not an exception. 20 years on from the reconciliation walks of the year 2000, this nation's journey towards a more just, equitable, and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to their elders past, present, and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
Mate, this is just impossible.
Too many people were confused.
You bet you are. You bet I am.
I have always believed in miracles.
That's not a policy.
Not now. Not ever.
I mean,
these comments are completely inappropriate.
Oh, I'm sure she's right.
You know, but I ain't spending any time on it.
How pathetic.
You're a classic space invader.
Disgusting, mud-sucking creatures.
You should be ashamed of yourselves.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
Welcome to Democracy Sausage Extra. I'm Mark Kenny from the ANU's Australian Studies Institute. I'm talking this week with two of the most scrupulously fair chroniclers of Australian politics, the Australian Financial Review's political editor Phil Currie and the Age and Sydney Morning Herald's chief political correspondent David Crowe. Now, I don't mind telling you there are none better than these two journalists if you want comprehensive, detailed and sophisticated coverage of national politics. So I'm delighted to have them here in our modest studio here at the ANU. And when I say federal politics, I mean that literally, because a key focus of this discussion is the way in which our two main levels of government have performed and how they've interacted with each other. Phil Currie, these are quite astonishing times, really, aren't they? We've seen governments expand like that sort of space invader foam into just about every aspect of the economy and society. And it's really been quite astonishing because there's been sort of little resistance to it. I suppose that's because we all understand what it's about, but it's astonishing to think about the powers that the state has at the moment.
Well, we're a fairly compliant nation. You know, we tend to, you know, grant our governments extra powers when they say they're needed, you know, whether it's terrorism and so, or so forth. But, and you only got to go back a few months at the start of this thing. I remember the initial news reports when the government said, oh, they must invoke laws to keep us socially separated and things. I remember when Christian Porter first raised that. And I remember back in February and March, I thought, how absurd, as if that's, you know, as if that's ever going to happen. Now look where we are. So, but the most, I think, astonishing or biggest change has been the exercise of power by the states. They've vested themselves extraordinary powers, plus they've used old powers they've had hanging around for ages. And in some stages, some situations like closing the borders, they've just made them up. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it is clearly unconstitutional what some of the premiers are doing, but no one other than Clive Palmer really wants to take them on over it, and we're just letting them do it. So it's sort of like this throwback almost to pre-federation. But the difference between now and 100 and something years ago was back then no one really moved around much and commerce was very local. Now, you know, everyone moves interstate, lives interstate, has family interstate, business doesn't really care about state borders. So it's thrown up just myriad complications and inconveniences across people's lives, whether it's, you know, farmers or sick kids trying to get to doctors or, you know, especially in these border communities. So I think that's my first sort of, you know, observation, what's going on. And secondly, I think this coronavirus has exposed flaws, glaring flaws in federation, things like aged care and border security. So you've seen what's going on in the aged care thing. You've got the federal government blaming the state governments and the state governments blaming the federal governments for what's happened. And it's the same with border security. You've got two federal agencies and a state agencies all standing around looking at each other saying it's not my problem. So just off the prima facie, these are the sorts of things we've not really tested before or had to live with, and I think there's quite big problems with both.
So what do you think, David? Are you surprised about the way in which we've accepted these rules, the police slapping huge fines on people, all these other rules? I mean, is it simply that this is sui generis, it's unique to this circumstance, this viral threat, people see it that way and fully expect all those powers to be wound back, and that's why they're not complaining about it? Or, I mean, is it a revelation to you, or would you have expected it to go this way?
No, I think it's gone as you would expect. People have been willing to knuckle down and do what they need to do to get the virus under control. I think there's been pushback at excessive policing. We saw that in Victoria, I think also in New South Wales in the early stages, where cops are going up to people, in the park. And I think there was pushback. Pushback at that. And it was ridiculous, because what we are learning is that being out in the open air is a safer place to be. So, there were problems in the early phases. I think that there'll still be later on a story to be told about how many of the fines were actually enforced and how many of them were successfully challenged.
That's a really interesting point, isn't it? Because I guess some people are just going to say, well, I had a legitimate reason to be there, or that was capricious.
And the magistrate will accept it.
Or I got no with a money, statement. What are you going to do?
Hopefully. Yeah. Hopefully they will.
Or I had to get a kebab.
I think that what's been really interesting to me is some of the points Phil made about this tension between the states and the feds and the lack of clarity about who's doing what, and it is getting to a maddening stage. And I think that one thing that happened in the last week or so highlighted that. It was the reporting to the Ruby Princess. We know that Scott Morrison stood at a press conference and said that he was putting the Australian Border Force in command of that situation. We know that the letter of the law was different, and the review into the Ruby Princess found that the Australian Border Force was not really in command. Who was in command? Well, it turned out to be New South Wales Health, after all. And so these kind of points about lack of clarity are, I think, the issues where there will be pushback from voters, because voters will not cop the excuses, and they won't cop this endless blame game where leaders point at each other and there's never a solution to what's going on. We are getting to a point where, even though we've got a national cabinet that does a very good job, that does get agreement at the high level, we're seeing this fragmentation beneath it over exactly who does what. Yeah. And aged care has been a really good example of that. And before we move along a bit, I think that came up just recently when Phil and I were actually talking about aged care in the press gallery corridor. Who does what? Why isn't aged care handed to the states? That's a big question that a big crisis like this forces you to think about.
Right now, I think Scott Morrison would probably like to hand it. Wishes he did.
Phil asked Scott Morrison that question. And
he didn't reject it, did he?
No, he didn't reject it, but he didn't. He looked a moment like he hadn't thought about it, but surely that's exactly what we need to be thinking about. The Federation is not working well enough. It's time to think about how to make it work better. This crisis is revealing the problems.
But the other thing, and I think is of a more serious level when it comes to our basic democratic rights, is people are having their lives incredibly adversely affected by decisions of government over which they have no say in, right? So Anastasia Palaszczuk's got an election coming in October, so she shuts her borders to New South Wales. By their very actions and the fact they rushed ads out hours later, it was an overtly political move. It was too heavy-handed. People in New South Wales, it doesn't just affect people in Queensland, that decision. It affects people everywhere else. And I know people who lost businesses because of that decision. Now, so you're having decisions made for you by governments that are affecting people outside the jurisdiction of that government. So you're basically right. Your basic right in a democracy is to vote against a government which annoys you. You don't even have that. So there's this, and you're seeing it with these cross-border, these border communities, where these outrageously sort of unfair things are being inflicted on people without logic or compassion.
Well, there was that case that was on AM a day or two ago. A little 3-year-old girl who was having cancer treatment in Adelaide and who
couldn't get there anymore.
Lived in Murraytown, I think, 20 kilometres the Victorian side of that border.
Fellow couldn't go from South Australia to bury his mother in Victoria because he would not allow to have been back into South Australia at all. He's a resident of that state.
Yeah.
Now, why he can't just have a COVID test before he goes home and isolates, you know, this sort of madness. So I think that impotence people are feeling now is also fueling this anger. And the governments have to be very careful because, you know, as we now know, the vaccine, if there is going to be one, is still 6 to 12 months away. And the government's going to keep asking us to make these extraordinary sacrifices through the Christmas period as well. And I think civil disobedience is not that far off. If they don't start just treating people compassionately and with logic, and, you know, rather than hide behind this catch cry of it's good politics. The number of state MP, state premier, press secretary said, oh, mate, but it's working really well here, like McGowan in Western Australia, has no business shutting his border to South Australia or the Northern Territory or the ACT for that matter, but it's work and treat politically.
And neither does really Queensland to the ACT either. I mean, they can run that argument that there's no hard border for the ACT.
I think with Queensland it's about northern New South Wales, isn't it? Because I think you can raise concerns about cities. Certainly there are clear hotspots in Sydney. But early on in this whole thing, Scott Morrison used to talk about localised lockdowns and even by local government area. And we're just not seeing that. We're not seeing the flexibility to treat regional New South Wales differently to the city of Sydney, where you've got clear outbreaks in a highly congested area. And so that flexibility is not being attempted.
We got close to it a couple of times. We got close to it in Tasmania and also in the early stages that preceded the stage 3 lockdown, the second lot in Victoria, didn't we, with those towers in North Melbourne.
Yes.
They were doing it by postcode there for a while, but the look of that, you know, is horrendous, isn't it, really, when you're sort of being blockades across streets and you know, people on one side of the street have free movement and people on the other side don't. And, you know,
it's better than the whole state. But I think now Victoria is so out of control. I don't think you can question the border closures with Victoria. But, well, in the case of South Australia, I think you should at least let your own residents back home, you know, with conditions. But I can understand the sort of nervousness around the Victorian border, but a lot of these other decisions are disproportionate and politically motivated, and you know, it's just not the best. What it really reflects is this retreat in our sentiment. We were killing this thing in terms of suppression, you know, and all the states agreed that we're going to live. We agreed on May 8 at National Cabinet. We had this thing successfully suppressed so we could start opening up our economies in 3 stages by the end of July. That was the agreement. And remember, the national mood was good. It was the best it'd been for a long time. The unemployment figures were fantastic for June as everyone started opening up again. And then and it was even the view of the PM and others that states would race to open up their economies to get a competitive advantage over those who stayed shut down. And that was the case. You know, they were gloating about, in South Australia and WA, about opening up while Victoria was still in clampdown. And now that whole mentality has turned on its head. It's now one of fear, you know, because Victoria has messed up and all the other premiers are looking at what's happening there, and no one's really interested anymore about opening
being up
their
first.
No, they just stick their hand, get Morrison to stick his hand in his pocket and bail them out.
Yeah, it's no longer about being first. It's about being toughest in terms of your protection.
It's a whole
of
mentality
your population
of retreat now, and that is not good. It's not good for the economy. It's not good for people's psyche because we've lost that sort of hope.
Although, look, I would okay, if Victoria gets the numbers down on the trajectory that they're currently on,
and they will,
then there is a chance of another, I guess, sense of optimism. And that's because that optimism that we felt in May and early June, when we didn't really know the full scale of what was happening in Melbourne, that optimism came because the measures worked, didn't they? Remember that early frenetic stage in March where, you know, Victoria and New South Wales were pushing harder for lockdowns and Morrison wasn't sure whether to go that hard. In the end, it actually worked. It got the first wave under control. If the Victorian numbers show that this wave will get under control, then I think that there's a chance that people will
have that sense of relief that we saw in May.
But will another premier who gets a few hours, this, but the trouble is other premiers who are getting just a handful of cases are panicking now. So this whole, the whole idea of learning to live with COVID was we would get our economies open. There would be outbreaks. Morrison said that. There's going to be setbacks, mistakes made, outbreaks. But the whole idea was to have the health system and the contact tracing and the testing regime so they could be contained and you could work around them. So New South Wales is probably the only example of, and the ACT by extension, of a jurisdiction that has fulfilled that promise to live in, to operate in a COVID-safe environment.
And it is an interesting contrast. They are bringing those outbreaks under control in New South
Wales. They've got good contact tracing.
And they're showing that it can be done. It's just that we saw the Victorian outbreak just grew so
well. That's the other end of the spectrum. That's what you don't do because they didn't have the tools in place. But in between, you've got
So just to stop there, you were saying they didn't have the contact tracing was nowhere near as good as New South Wales.
It was terrible.
And so as a result of that, when the numbers came out, they escalated very quickly. What contact tracing they did have was overwhelmed by the task then in terms of numbers, and that becomes.
But this is the thing. I mean, it's incredibly politically contentious to make judgments about, you know, one state versus the other. But this is a completely unforgiving pandemic. Every leader gets judged on the numbers. Mm. And, you know, you can look at New South Wales and you can actually see that they are faster and more effective at bringing outbreaks under control. The numbers show that.
Because when they did that May 8 agreement, they all agreed at National Cabinet that you had the vital sort of preconditions for reopening was testing, tracing, and a robust health system, and so you could protect your elderly and your vulnerable, while you could corral these outbreaks. Now, the whole idea of contact tracing was if someone got the coronavirus diagnosed, anyone with whom they'd been in contact had to be traced within 24 hours. Now, only on Friday last week did Daniel Andrews say Victoria's now doing that. Of 99% of the cases. So 2 months it's taken them to get to where the starting point was. And that was because, you know, there's been Channel 9's reported that they let all these contact tracers go in June and back into the health department. The health department there didn't have the logistics in place. They didn't want the army or the police involved. Gladys Berejiklian, by comparison, set up three floors of a government office building in Sydney with a former police commissioner in charge of logistics. Anastasia Palaszczuk has probably the best system in the country. I mean, she had, seven cases a week ago. They got none again, right? So if Queensland and New South Wales had this, you know, the same systems as Victoria, that'd be New South Wales would be getting 100, 200 cases a day by now. In Victoria, there were people getting text messages 2 weeks after they'd been in contact with someone with coronavirus. In New South Wales, they're getting them within 12 to 24 hours, and that is just absolutely critical. So that's the error. I mean, what's done is done, but it sort of shows it was an anomaly. It's not an evidence that we're going to eliminate this virus. It's just you can live with it, but you got to have your act together.
And let's go back to that point about what happens when going to your point, David, about the possibility of some level of optimism coming back once Victoria is under control. We've just seen New Zealand have a very small number of cases and very quickly apply a lockdown of Auckland. That seems to be – there's obviously – I mean, that's a government that's facing election too. Mm. So Jacinda Ardern no doubt does not want the situation running out of control for any reason. I mean, you know, for good health reasons, of course, but also for political reasons. So Phil's point is right, isn't it, that there'll be this kind of hair trigger approach to any outbreaks in the future. Is that correct?
I think so.
Yeah.
And I think also that people can accept that if you go hard and you act as swiftly as possible, then you are actually making the right decision for the economy in the long term.
I mean, one of the issues here is that it's a lag indicator, and that's what Jacinda Ardern was making the point, that when you find out you've got cases, then you've had cases for some period of time, right? And that's why you need to, you know, she says as soon as you have any cases, act. But, of course, that can be devastating for the economy.
Yeah, but they're sort of – New Zealand's an example. The elimination strategy only goes so far.
Mm.
You have to wipe your economy right out to try and eliminate it, and you're still going to get outbreaks. So, you know, where we – they've done a very good job over there, but it's easier to manage a country of just 3 or 4 million people.
And with no states.
With no states. And everything's unilateral.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of these things that's exposed is almost the powerlessness of the Commonwealth. I mean, other than a checkbook.
Well, I was looking at something the other day about the difference between Britain and Australia during the Second World War, and when it came to, you know, reconstruction plans, you know, to get the economy going, to keep it geared up, and to have reconstruction after the war, the sorts of reforms that they were able to get through in Britain, they weren't able to get through in Australia because of that that federation. The states just wouldn't buy into it. So you had the creation of the NHS and the nationalisation of coal and things like that that came out of the British Reconstruction, but in Australia we were much more timid. So it is quite interesting the way the machinery of Australia, the way it's set up, has it makes that sort of progress quite hard.
Well, as everyone says, if you started from scratch, you wouldn't have the states in Australia, or you'd redesign it differently. But But it's, you know, they're governments. They've got their patches to win. They're electorates to impress, and that's what they're doing. And
but it's an interesting point about the economic recovery, because the premiers are contributing in terms of the economic recovery. There is a cost to Victoria, and it's incurring that, and it's taking on debt to do that. But we are seeing an argument about who's doing the real heavy lifting on that. And if and you can understand that National Cabinet, I think, in a better world, would now be moving to a bigger debate about the economic recovery. But they're still grappling with these breakouts and with lockdowns. And we're not seeing from the states, I think, enough focus on the economic recovery because they're so busy on other fronts.
Maybe we will get that
repeat of history where they are actually holding back national agreements about the economic recovery, because I think you actually have to look at some very big ideas to lift Australia out of this recession, bigger than the ideas from the global financial crisis. And that requires buy-in from the premiers, and I don't think the national debate has got anywhere near to that yet.
On the global financial crisis, all three of us covered it at the time, and you know, we were, as people covering it, we were well aware of what was happening in other parts of the world, and we were, you know, staying close to government ministers and finding out what decisions were being made and on the basis of what fears those decisions were being made. But then, of course, the electorate didn't really experience much in the way of hardship from the GFC at all. I wonder whether, just bearing that in mind, whether there was a bit of that sense after the first wave, if I can put it like that. You know, you talked about the optimism, whether there was a sense that, well, we got past it, and it's not, you know, there's a sort of a bit of Australian exceptionalism again. We've got through it.
I think that is an element in some parts of the community. Some parts of the community are not feeling it that badly. I mean, look, there are some who are protected by government job or other jobs in areas which are still secure. You're not feeling it,
or if you're in WA or something like that. I mean,
depending on location. Kind of... Also, some people have been insulated through JobKeeper. That's not enough for some people, but for others, it's actually been okay. I'm finding it really interesting looking at some of the company results where there are companies still doing okay. And, you know, they're still selling stuff. People are still buying. So this will change when we see JobKeeper and JobSeeker cut back and then JobSeeker stop. JobSeeker temporary increase will stop. And so I think that's the really tough question, how tough it's going to be after that point.
But I even think before that it was a lot worse than the GFC. You know, because Labor did what they did in the GFC and rolled all that money out the door, no one lost their job. I mean, unemployment didn't even go over 6%. It stayed with a 5 in front of it.
A lot of people were actually better off.
Yeah. Well, I remember, you know, interest rates fell 4
interest
points,
rate, yeah.
For 4%. And I remember just piling money onto my mortgage at the time, because we all still had our jobs.
Yeah.
So we were all still getting paid.
And there were people getting checks in the mail.
Yeah, and everything was cheap. And, you know, the government was – it was actually a pretty good time if you were working. I mean, the bill came later, of course, but in terms of debt and so forth. But, you know – now it just strikes you what a good job Labor did, and how unfounded and how unfair so many of those petty criticisms that the coalition levelled at the time.
Yeah, that's why I've tried to put that to a few ministers at the press club. They don't ever get much of
I mean, a handful of checks to dead people. I mean, you know, JobSeeker paid $6 billion in excess wages, you know, which was the size of the surplus for this year. I mean, there's been so many unintended consequences and what you could argue is waste with this thing. So I think it's put that argument to bed forever. The Labor mismanaged the GFC, no way. But back to the point, you know, that even though we got through this thing by sort of June, people still had the pants frightened off them for those. Remember those long dole queues? Remember how scared we were when we saw those long? We didn't see that in the GFC.
Yeah, but that's what brought the wage subsidy.
Oh, I know, but JobKeeper still didn't. JobKeeper was like a comfort blanket that made people, but it still was just, it was a Band-Aid that was, remember it was 6 months,
And they were quite strong.
No, I know people who lost businesses who had workers on JobKeeper. None of that happened during the GFC, or very little happened in the GFC. So the starting point for this thing was a lot more frightening and a lot more sobering, you know, for anyone.
Yeah, but, I know. But, I was just merely making the point that psychologically there was this sense once we'd got past the peak and the numbers were right down and it looked like Australia was licking it.
I think it was the relief, Mark, because we were conditioned to thinking this thing's going to go, you know, remember Morrison saying at least 6 months and possibly into next year.
Whatever we do, we have to do for 6 months, he kept saying.
And that's the time frame they're working on. So I think it was just this sense of relief when we started getting out of it and we had this thing suppressed. Remember the numbers went down to nothing and
there was food back on the supermarket shelves.
Yeah, and the dunny paper returned. And
That's right. And in a sense, that does highlight the anxiety because it was easy to kind of laugh at the people stocking up on loo paper, but that was a really interesting and I think important indicator in retrospect about the community anxiety.
Yeah, I agree. And it was funny. I saw a list of the symptoms that, you know, because they're studying this virus and they're now trying to order the way symptoms emerge. And there's some new work being done on surveying people who've been infected and getting them to keep diaries about when they notice particular symptoms. And this is teaching them new things about how to map the virus and how it operates. And one of those things, funnily enough, one of those symptoms is diarrhea. Now, remember how often we were told, you know, during that whole loo thing that it had nothing to do with that end of your body. And turns out, well, actually, it does. You know, there's a fever and there's cough and there's the aches and diarrhea is one of them. Anyway,
Didn't get that in the GFC either.
No, that's true. On that runny note, we'll just take a very quick break.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. Now, we won't talk any more about diarrhea, I promise. But what I am interested in getting your views on, and this is perhaps a sort of a more philosophical point, but why is it that we have some societies, and this is true of democracies, not just, you know, radically different polities to ours, but some that are quite similar, that respond completely differently, essentially, to the same information. Like New Zealand, obviously, they lock down everyone. Everyone's, you know, rowing in the same direction. Australia's been pretty much that sort of story. But there are places around the world where even with vast numbers of deaths, they are still defiantly not wearing masks. They are still refusing to close down their economies. I'm just interested, what is the sort of different psyche about that? Is that a different psyche about government, or is it about different psyche about death?
The comparison is the US
where you've that's got that obvious, cohort of people who will never accept the authority of the central government, and that's deeply ingrained into an element of that society. It's an interesting contrast with Australia.
But even state governments, I mean, even the state, you know, they're resisting state governments as well.
But don't forget, I mean, I think one of the things that's led to, you know, fairly orderly behaviour is we have a very good health and welfare system.
Yeah.
So people, you know, over there, if the government makes you stay home, you don't eat. In the US, you know, there's one of the cruelest societies in the OECD, if not. It's, you know, for such a wealthy society, it's an extraordinarily cruel way. And, you know, poverty is treated as a sin there rather than something to be helped. So, you know, if you don't work, you don't eat, you know, and there's no Medicare, there's no free COVID testing, there's no, you know, here we got free COVID tests. The Prime Minister is promising a free vaccination if and when someone develops one. Yeah, we're getting a wage subsidy. It's we have such a good welfare and health system that I think that just calms people. But if you don't have that, you know, you're just not going to do. You know, you're going to be scared and you're going to react.
And part of that's material in all those things you've just listed, and part of it's about trust because there's something coming back the other way from the government.
Yes, yes,
yeah. And you're realizing now in America, it's revealing those flaws in the society at a much greater scale than we've seen, and they've always been there. And the treatment of the underclass has always been like that. And now
it's been laid bare.
What's
the joke? You know, if you want to know if you got it in America, just cough on a rich person. You know,
But there's also Sweden, right? So Sweden went for a completely different approach to Australia, and I think that they've realised the flaws of the more open slather approach. And I've got to say, I wasn't expecting Sweden to be the kind of society that took that approach.
But
they've got a different government structure as well. I think they were bound by the medical advice to take that direction. But I think that they've been caught out, and they're seeing that it was not the way to go. And some of them in Sweden have actually acknowledged that.
Yeah, but I think there have been a few examples around where even when they've had what to us would be very worrying numbers. I mean, we've been sweating on these numbers of new infections in Victoria, you know, when they were in the 400s and the 500s and then, you know, a couple over 700. And obviously some of the death toll numbers on a daily basis, mainly in aged care, but nonetheless in some other places as well. They've been big news in Australia. And then you look overseas and you see places where having significantly higher numbers and yet essentially still got the place running. And I wonder also whether in the US it isn't about just essentially being more conversant with death, you know, with violence. I mean, people get killed there all the time in gun violence.
Well, there's less empathy for your fellow man or woman.
It's a cutthroat society.
Dog eat dog, you know.
Yeah.
Hey, sucker, you died too bad. You know, they don't have that empathy that, you know, we have, for example. But I think in other countries, bad government. I mean, Britain has handled this almost as appallingly as the US. They're just a bit more civilised over there. But Boris Johnson was appalling in his early management of this thing, and they still haven't even shut their borders properly and so forth. So, you know, and they have a pretty crappy health system. It's not worse than ours, but nowhere near as bad as America's. So that's a sort of an in-between example. But they have a shocking rate, you know, of infection and death over there. But they're just stoic about it.
It's so revealing too that the American share market is back up again.
Yeah, I heard today that the rebound was the strongest on record from a bear market.
Think, where they were at
April. Rich man don't get the Rona.
And that's the thing. They are shrugging off the level of death as long as the market's
You can
okay.
buy yourself health over there. And fundamentally, I mean, nothing structurally wrong with the economy. I mean, the difference from the GFC, that was, the banks collapsed on the low doc loans and it ricocheted through the banking system through the Northern Hemisphere. And the whole economy just suffered almost a structural collapse. There's not, as the June unemployment numbers showed in Australia, as soon as this thing went away, everyone opened up again and we started getting back to normal very quickly. So, you know, where there's wealth, there's protection. And whereas in Australia, we're sharing the wealth, we're a much more equitable society.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're using enormous sums of taxpayers' money to cushion it. But over there, you just buy yourself buy yourself protection and get back to it. And these companies, I mean, everyone makes money in a crisis, you know.
And there's a lot of pent-up demand when you come out of it,
Drug companies, online sales, I mean, not everyone's suffering here. There's plenty of dough to be made out of misery.
Well, what will be fascinating, though, will be the extent to which we see change in the way work is done. I mean, lots of enterprises that you talk to, they've been going through rationalisation. I mean, they're forced into it by having no cash flow and and you know, going back to tours a bit in terms of whatever it is that they do, and thinking about how many people they'll have on afterwards, it's hard to imagine we're not going to see quite a significant tail of long-term unemployment out of this.
Yeah.
Even though we will have bounce back. You know, the balance sheet will look good, but there'll be a lot of people on the dole.
Worse than the global financial crisis, no question. And I think this is the big – the big issue. I mean, how long will that go on for, and who actually has a plan to lift them back out of unemployment, if that's even possible? Because I can still remember Wayne Swan saying during the GFC, remember that some people who are unemployed now don't get back.
Yeah.
And this is the thing about
especially,
you know,
if they're over 50 or whatever.
Right. Yeah. The cost of the different age groups.
Yeah.
No, and that was one of the admirable things Labor did. They just kept people in work, and it just.
I'm
more optimistic with this one, because I just think I'm quite buoyed by the comments in recent days and weeks about the likelihood of a vaccine, and I just think if there is one, I think the economy can recover very quickly because, as I said, you know, there aren't any structural flaws. So I'm a bit more confident the unemployment lag may not be as bad as it has been in other recessions, despite the forecast, because people will just get back to work. But it is fast-tracking trends that were already happening, like the decline of retail. Will everyone open shops again?
A lot of people have been shopping online for the first time.
Well, that's right.
Are they going to go back to it?
Oh, yeah, Solomon Lew, the premium group, has got all those shops. I think his online sales have gone up something like 1,000%. Our industry, I work for newspapers. Our newspaper sales aren't great. They weren't great before this. They're even less great now, but our online traffic is going through the roof. So it's accelerating, I think trends that were happening. And I said we'll see changes like that in the workplace and society, but I'm not convinced this work-at-home thing's going to take off. Everyone I know who's been working from home just wants to get out of there and get back to the office.
I've been wondering too about some of the infrastructure stuff. Do we really need to fast track the Western Sydney Airport, given the outlook for aviation over the near term? What do we need in terms of urban infrastructure if people do start shifting towards working from home? A little bit more. Now, they may not do that 5 days a week, but maybe they'll work from home one of those 5 days.
That's certainly been my experience.
Yeah, you'll do a bit more from home than you normally did.
But my experience here at ANU has been that you can be more flexible about when you come. So if you've got a meeting at 10 o'clock, you can come in at sort of 9:30 or whatever. You might have been sitting at your computer for 2 hours at home, but you can do that. And the thing is, you can park. Right. Normally around here you can't. If you don't get here early, you can't park.
Maybe they're annoyed everyone's going to get back. When everyone gets back to work and you can't get parks. I know guys in Sydney who are driving to work for the first time in their lives because you can.
And you're more confident there's not going to be a parking inspector around.
That's true.
They've even
bagged some of the parking meters up in some parts of Canberra that I've seen.
But getting back to Crowe's point, I mean, there will be, we're going to hit 10% unemployment, which is almost double the GFC, and it will take a long time, even despite my optimism. And
especially if you work in aviation or any of those related sectors.
The jobs just aren't going to reappear.
Yeah,
and job generation is just crucial. Employment generation, and speaking from experience, I spent a year on the dole. After the recession in 91, and it's miserable. It is absolutely miserable. It happens in phases where you think you'll get work in the area you're qualified, then that won't happen. So you get something less in your qualified area, then you realize you'll get nothing at all in your qualified area. So you go for other jobs, then you don't get those. Then you start going to bottle shops asking for work, and then you start offering to work for free. And then on it goes, on it goes.
Then
it goes.
You just want to go to the bottle shop.
Well, you just spiral. And you lose all your confidence and stuff. I've been there. It is the worst thing, and there's going to be a lot of that. And so
because there'd be a lot of let's be honest, right? There'd be a lot of senior management people who are thinking, you know, that saying that we heard it said a lot in the early part of this: "Don't waste a crisis." Hmm. Well, there'd be a lot of business people who'll be thinking, we too are having a crisis, and now is the time, under the cover of this, and I don't mean that in a sort of malicious way, but under the stress of all this, now is the time to do that restructure. Mm. Everyone's going to understand that, you know, we face different circumstances. We're going to close off that division. We're no longer going to do that thing that we were planning to do that everyone was excited about. We're not doing it anymore.
Put it on hold for a few years. Yeah.
And if you replicate that even a bit, across the economy, you're talking about quite a few.
Yeah, well, I think it's where Morrison is correct in saying you've got, you know, part of the solution is getting businesses to invest and employ again. I mean, nine out of ten of us work in the private sector, so everything has to be geared towards creating employment, from the October budget on, just everything. And there are numerous ways to do that, but easier said than done. Mm.
I think that we've still got to see a big answer on this question. We all know that, say, when the October budget comes around, there are going to be questions about things like a business investment allowance, right? Mm-hmm. This is the idea that encourages business investment. It's a bit like a company tax cut, but it's more targeted. And we all know that this is the thing that's out there in the agenda as one option for them to do. And the federal government can do that.
And Labor point will to support it. Labor actually took a business investment.
That's right. I think you could lock it in.
One of the problems for Labor is sometimes they get told, don't talk about it too much, because when the government hears that it's your idea, the government doesn't want to do it. But let's face it.
I think they've already signed off on it.
it's one option. But I don't think it's enough. I mean, you're looking at people who've got skills, find that those skills are no longer needed, need a job. And I think that the reskilling message out of the federal government is still insufficient.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, you're talking about, a six-month online TAFE course? People are going to need a lot more than that. And there are some people with very, very good skills. I heard about a pilot the other day, obviously with redundancies and massive write-downs. There are planes being taken out of commission.
Yeah.
He'll probably never fly again as a commercial pilot. Maybe that may change, right? But at a certain age, people have to start thinking about doing something completely different. And I think that is going to require a very big effort from the federal government on reskilling a workforce.
And that's why it makes no sense whatsoever to sort of wage this ideological war against universities as part of this.
No, I couldn't agree more.
I mean, you can sort of mount a technical argument as to why the universities don't get JobKeeper, because supposedly they've got huge cash reserves or whatever, but it just reeks of an ideology. Mm. And it's just so incongruous that at a time where we're on our knees begging science to save us.
Yes.
We're at the mercy of our researchers. Not just in medical science for our frontline, but for our technology people, for our internet providers.
And we've heard so much for years about Australia's global competitiveness being this,
And they're sticking the knife into the unis. I mean, the unis are suffering. You were talking earlier, Mark, about things that are being fast-tracked, the demise of. I mean, I think probably one good thing that will come out of this in the university sector is they'll ease their reliance on Chinese students, which has been a dangerous build-up over recent years, and we've seen what China's doing to everyone else. Once they get this dependency, they start using it against you. But in the short to medium term, it's a whacking hit on university revenue and their ability to do what they do. So it doesn't make sense.
It's also just self-defeating because this is such an important employer sector, employment sector, and it's been such an important export sector for the economy. So to just sort of say, oh, well, you're on your own.
I can understand why the government wants to encourage STEM, right, and wants to offer a fee incentive for doing more science, doing more maths. That's great. But what I don't understand is why that comes at the cost of other students, because their fees have to go up. If you look across the economy, pretty much any sector of the economy can go to the government now and make a case and say, can you help us? The one sector of the economy that gets no extra dollars is the universities.
Mm.
And I understand that the universities have taken on a corporate model and they're selling a product overseas, and they're now suffering from a global shock, right? That happens in business.
They should get JobKeeper.
But the fact that they cannot get any assistance makes no sense.
I think they should be facilitating, like the same way they're facilitating skills, they should be facilitating to university degrees, like rather than putting one up and one down. And I think even cutting HECS fees or offering incentives across the board, because we're going to need.
And the other thing is the generational issue that we're seeing with this crisis.
Imagination and courage, right? Mm. That's what it actually involves: imagination and courage. And we just haven't seen that level of. We've seen them get out the checkbook, obviously with JobKeeper and JobSeeker, but we just haven't seen that level.
I can understand that when the budget's coming up, Morrison will take what's called the path of least resistance, because he, in terms of things like the business tax incentive and stuff like that, he knows he has to get things going quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So he's not going to spend you know, 3 years arguing with the Senate about cutting company taxes again because it's a waste of time and it probably won't happen. So do the tax incentive knowing Labor will support it. And there's going to be a few things like that, like these industrial relations changes. They're not – that they're discussing with the ACTU. They're not radical. They're sort of areas where there's a mutually agreed sort of – or there's a mutual consensus that there's problems and it shouldn't be too hard to get consensus on a few of them of the way through. So I think that's smart in the short – immediate policy term, but you're right. You're going to have to probably on a secondary level think, you know, more courageously in terms of reform and so forth.
Well, there's federation reform. They really have to rethink who does what and be clearer about it. That this crisis is showing that. This crisis is also showing the generational issue that has been talked about for the last 5 or 10 years. I mean, there's been good work done by the Grattan Institute and others showing the relative benefit to those who are older, because they're getting more tax breaks when they're approaching retirement and so forth, and how tough it is for some of the younger ones now. And now we've got a government that it could make it a lot more tougher for some of those young people with higher fees, higher hex debts.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a limit to how much debt you can put on the young kids.
Can you imagine being 21 now?
Yeah.
You know, and you just, and you get out of uni, you owe the government 70 or 80 grand for your degree. You know the nation will be in debt and deficit for the entirety of your working life.
Yeah.
So you're going to be paying higher and higher income taxes. You've got sod all chance of buying a bloody house. That's one thing that hasn't come down in price.
And you're leaving university into a recession.
Yes.
Which hasn't happened to an – well, since I left university, basically.
But since you left this university.
Yeah, that's right. And so that – you know, I think the government has to be thinking bigger about what it does to address that issue, because that's a lot of disaffected people unless you've got an answer for them about what you're going to do.
And that's a big test for Scott Morrison, because he's shown he's got some pretty good sort of politics chops. I mean, he, for example, he comes out with some – he gets the note of policy sometimes wrong, but – he's fairly quick to change, and he's done that a number of times. And I think, you know, to his credit, we want a government to be flexible in the face of new information and so forth. But nonetheless, you know, it's infuriated some people. But we don't see much evidence of big, bold, imaginative policy at this stage.
He's
maybe
not a policy thinker, the Prime Minister. He's a fixer.
Yeah.
He's a very good fixer. Show him a problem, I'll fix it. You know, he's a good sort of logistics guy. I'll set up structures to, you know, to deal with the problem and stuff. But he's not a visionary.
Mm.
You know, and who in the cabinet is going to come up with the big vision for the recovery? It's I mean, what we've seen at the moment is a lot of ministers are very low profile. It really is the Scott Morrison show at a federal level.
Just like the election campaign.
Like the election campaign. It worked for them with the election. It's working for them now. But you're not seeing ministers out there champing at the bit to go and start crusading about what they want to fix.
Well, if you're Josh Frydenberg, you are – I mean, you may not wish it to be this way, but you're a treasurer who has been handed a responsibility like few treasurers. I mean, people talk about the great treasurers or the dominant treasurers anyway, people like Paul Keating and Peter Costello, you know, who dominated the parliament at the time they were there. They were a big weight within the governments they were in. Frydenberg is the treasurer at this moment, and it is a great moment of economic peril and, I guess, opportunity down the track for the country, depending on how he responds to it. So this budget is a big test for him, isn't it?
Huge. He's also got a bit of a challenge. When he was energy minister, he had an energy minister above him, which was Malcolm Turnbull.
Yeah.
Now he's treasurer. He's got a treasurer above him, and that's Scott Morrison.
Yeah. I think that's why Matthias Cormann might be shuffling off as well. I think he'll be a big loss. Cormann will be a big loss to them in a budgetary sense. But
in terms of the contestability of the arguments within the cabinet.
He was the sort of last of the disciplinarians. So, but I suspect, you know, he's sort of been squeezed out. He was going to go anyway, but I think he feels less compunction. He feels less needed.
Now, we're getting close to time, but there is another issue that I want to just get your response to, and that is just your opinions about the choice of Kamala Harris and what that means. I mean, Phil, you're a former US correspondent.
I like her. I think she's very impressive. I like her a lot more than either Biden or Trump, to be honest.
Yeah.
I see Biden, I think I'm a great grandfather. you know, look, most thinking people yeah, we can't have Trump again. It's just God, goodness, how disastrous it would be. But I don't discount the possibility of him winning. In fact, I think it's quite possible he will win again. But Harris, like, she just – like, I don't know a lot. I don't know her or anything like that. But she strikes me as extraordinarily bright, competent, strong. I look at her and, you know, I think Biden's best chance is you sort of create this impression over the next couple of months, you vote for me, you get her.
Yeah.
She's just – so much. I don't know. She just strikes me a very impressive person. And look, it's not just America needs it. The world needs it. To be honest,
yeah.
we can't put up with this fellow for another four years. It'll be devastating, you know, for the region.
I've long been of the view. Just before we come to you on this, David, I've long been of the view that Trump wouldn't win because, you know, he's, as I've told listeners of this podcast a few times, I think he's energized his opponents much more effectively than he's grown his own base. I think he's energized his base, but I don't see much evidence that he's grown it. Now, that said, I do think, and I've noticed Trump's tone in the last few days, a couple of his improvised speeches have actually been quite good. I mean, you know.
Oh, yeah, he's reinventing himself.
Yeah. And I'm wondering whether there isn't this horrible sort of vortex of terror that I'm sort of thinking about now where Trump has set the bar so low that any improvement makes him look semi-presidential.
I think it's spot on. That's exactly what he's doing. And, you know, memories are about a minute long in the US. And
We speak the same language. We are immersed in American culture. We think we understand the place. We don't really understand it. There's an element of that society that's drawn to Trump. And so you can never really sit back and think, oh, no, they can't possibly re-elect Donald Trump. They can. They did it last time. They can do it again. Except with Kamala Harris, one thing that the Democrats have got now is a way in which they can mobilize more voters to get out and vote. And that's one thing that Hillary did not do. That was the crucial failing.
She did have 3 million more votes, though, than Trump.
Yeah, but she didn't mobilize votes in the same way that Obama did.
And she energized.
And that was a big
gap. She energized Trump supporters by calling them deplorables. But
yeah.
And so if Kamala Harris helps the Democrats turn that around, then mission accomplished, and that could be the decisive factor. So it's actually, you know, it's a smart move. What I also find really interesting about her is one of the criticisms is that people don't know what she stands for because she's been so cautious. And to me, it shows that that is one way in which, as a politician, you've got to be careful. She hasn't gone out too hard to alienate people on the left or the right through her career. She's been very cautious, and it's actually paid off for her with the nomination.
She just looks like the future. Neither Trump nor Biden look like the future.
No.
And you just think, God, in a country of 300 million people, that's the two best you can come up with. You know, I mean, I'm not down on Biden, but I just think, you know, his time has come.
Yeah, he's just too old.
Even though they don't sort of care much about age in America like we do here, but he doesn't look like a bloke who's going to do 8 years in the White House.
No.
Yeah, look, be honest about it.
And that kind of becomes a possible attraction to voters. Well,
that's what I mean. It becomes it because
they say, well, okay, so it's Biden, then it's Kamala.
It's Kamala. That's what I mean. That's she offers a path through.
And for some, that's a positive, and for some, it will be a negative.
Yeah.
You know, because of the race question and because of the gender question.
Well, yeah, that's them to get over that rubbish. But
well,
we need it in the region. We need change in this region in the Asia Pacific.
Yeah,
we need leadership from America again. We need re-engagement in the region.
Couldn't agree more.
Trump's not going to give us that.
No.
And we're having to do more of the heavy lifting with the Japanese and the Koreans, and China has used the last 4 years to really sort of divide and conquer in the region.
This is the thing. This is the thing about the Donald Trump presidency. When people look back on it, the man who said make America great again has been fantastic for China.
This is
the thing that Americans may realize at this election or may realize at a later point, but that president has let them down big time.
Yeah. I mean, Obama made mistakes. Obama was too soft. So he kept redrawing red lines. You know, if you cross this line, okay, I drew another line. So it was under Obama that China really sort of took over the South China Sea and the East China Sea. And that's a common criticism both here and in the region. But Obama knew the value of alliances. And the thing is, Trump doesn't put any value in alliances. And we're seeing this push now to basically this safety in numbers push by Australia and Japan, others, that you get every country in the Indo-Pacific, including India, Indonesia, Vietnam, Philippines, and you just use sort of force of numbers to try and, you know, stare down China and just force it to behave itself. That's now what we're resorting to. And that really needs someone in the White House who's not an isolationist, both economically and militarily. So, you know, that's from the Australian perspective, that's where, you know, that's why they're all secretly hoping Biden wins.
That's why I was amazed when I saw John Howard talking to Kieran Gilbert a month or so ago, and he was just pathetic on it. I thought it was really disgraceful what Howard had to say. He said Biden's not a strong alternative. It was Howard saying, you know, I'm sticking with Trump. And I think for a genuine conservative to be sticking with such a wrecker, someone who is so obviously antithetical to the best interests of this country and to the conservative brand and to democracy.
And against the best interests of the United States of America.
Yeah, and exactly.
Remember the press club in 2016, John Howard called him manifestly unsuited for the role. So.
Yeah, and Howard, you know, he could claim, oh, well, I don't like to get involved, I don't have a vote. But we know he had a crack at Obama when he was prime minister.
Yeah, that's right. No, I was surprised at those comments. I thought it'd be a bit more judicious than that.
But you can never really underestimate the tribal nature of politics these days, including here. It's not as bad as it is in the States, but John Howard cannot bring himself to say that the Democrat candidate is the safer option.
No, I know. And, I mean, Greg Sheridan in The Australian wrote some very critical stuff about Donald Trump for the last few years, but now every piece seems to be. And
not everything Trump's done has been evil or stupid. I mean, some of his foreign policy has been quite simplistically brilliant, you know, in terms of just ignoring the conventions and getting to the point and calling things out. And,
yeah, I agree.
Look, the Chinese, as much as they've sort of flourished under him, they sort of don't like his volatility, and they're keen to see him gone because his volatility scares them. You know, he could just turn on them one day and do something mad. So it's sort of like, yeah, he's like the drunk guy in the bar walking around with a beer, waving it like a loaded gun, you know, whatever. You just don't know whether he's going to turn on you. So, you know, that's from their perspective. But, you know, not everything he's done has been silly. I think he's standing up to China in the way he has been good. You know, trying to re-engage with North Korea might not have borne much, but, you know, he's just prepared to do things differently.
Yeah, I agree. I mean,
but that's from an American perspective. Sure. It hasn't been to the benefit of the rest of us. So.
Yeah, but it has been interesting to see him bust through some of those sclerotic conventions and get some things done. That's true.
I still see him as somebody whose tenure will be shown to be a period of weakening American power globally. Yeah. And so
absolutely.
That's the ultimate cost. It's at a time where China's power is strengthening. I mean, that's the real
– It's a worrying time. Shift. It's a worrying time. I remember John Howard at a speech in Chicago in 2005 when everyone was jumping ugly on George Bush over the Iraq War, and you know, rightfully so, because that was a disaster. And everyone's predicting the demise of America. And I remember Howard gave this speech at the Foreign Affairs Society, and he said, be careful what you wish for. If America isn't sort of running the world, who do you want, Putin or the Chinese? You know, and it was a good – and I think we're now approaching that point. I came away from that G20 in Argentina. Was it the end of 2018, Crowe? Yeah. Yeah, when MBF, you know, the Saudi had just murdered the journalist, was high-fiving Putin.
And that was scary.
And suddenly it was sort of laid bare that the world was being run by bad men. Bad men who were just off on a frolic. And the Europeans are weak. You know, Merkel's weak. She's a lame duck. The French have no real clout. And because America, you know, well, Trump admires these people.
Yeah.
You know, he admires it, but he doesn't – you know, look what China's doing in Hong Kong.
Yeah. You think well, they'd be doing that if you had – Colin Powell's making in his
– You think they'd be doing that if you had a strong US president? Probably not. You know, and it's been like that for a while now. There are bad men now in charge of the world in very powerful positions, whether it's Turkey or Russia or China or Saudi or the US. And where's the force – you know, for all America's flaws – where's the force for sort of democracy and good? It's not that obvious anymore.
No, that's right. Mm. Well, on that depressing note, we'll have to wrap up. Thanks, Phil Currie and David Crowe for coming into the ANU studio for this Democracy Sausage Extra. It's been terrific having this discussion. It's just like old times, actually, like we're sitting around in the corridor in the press gallery. Really great to have you here, and we'll look forward to doing so again at some point soon.
No worries. Cheers, Mark.
Bye for now.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.